courtyard outside the entrance. In the event of a medical or fire emergency, please call 911 and notify the security agent at the front desk. The nearest defibrillator is mounted on the steps leading from the reception desk down to Grand Avenue. A fire extinguisher is located in the corridor to the right of the dais as you leave the chamber. Okay, our first work session topic is the Regional Investment Strategy Transportation Investment Measure Update, and would love to invite Andy Shaw and Tyler Frisbee to present. Thank you.
So we are mainly here to provide you an update on Transportation Funding Task Force's work, but I thought I'd do a couple brief updates on other work going on. So in parks, following the conversation at here on March 19th, the team is gearing up for a very deep month of engagement during April. The stakeholder table meets this coming Monday once again. Staff are going to present at MPAC on Wednesday.
Wednesday
at MPAC, and my understanding is the stakeholder table is Monday the 8th. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yes. There is also an engagement this Friday that I think you had emailed us about, Councilor Lewis, yes, with a variety of members of conservation, indigenous community, some of our jurisdictional partners to walk through some of the elements. We're working on website communications materials, online survey to be posted by April 15th, so looking for lots of ways to get input from a variety of quarters on the developing parks funding proposal. Staff are then going to come to Council with all the engagement results and recommendations for the bond package at the May 14th work session. So that's our plan for the next month and a half on parks. And at this point, we're hoping to be able to schedule a council referral decision on May 30th at your council meeting. We'll try to stick with that timeline. It's a tight timeline after the recommendation coming on the 14th. If we can't achieve it at that point, then we would have to wait until mid-June because of some outs, some people missing early in June for a decision on the referral. Unless there's questions there, shifting to housing, thank you for the approval on that first phase project with the resolution on March 21st. The Oversight Committee holds its third meeting tomorrow, and they're still sort of in the norming phase of their work, orienting themselves and getting ready for the work. An exciting note I heard is we were thinking about having them meet less often just as a regular course of matter, and they actually indicated they were willing and interested in meeting more often to get ready for and get the work coming done. So that's a good note on their sense of themselves and their working together. And staff will be coming back for a work session on housing on April 30th for an update and council discussion on developing implementation strategies, how that process is going. So today, though, we are here to give you a relatively brief update on the work in transportation, and Tyler's going to take you away.
Good afternoon. That's on. Okay. You are here. That was supposed to be all ambulance talking.
Slide, yeah.
So we'll just revisit that. As a reminder for the transportation funding process, we are right where that lovely circle is. So we are in the process where the task force is both identifying and then prioritizing corridors. And this work is happening. Their first two meetings, they spent talking about the values and the outcomes that you as a council put forward, and they added some of their own and talked about what those meant and how to apply those to their work. And then at the last meeting, they talked about what corridors they wanted to consider for potential inclusion in a measure. So for the values conversation, this is the Wordle from their conversation. And I think generally we were really pleased with how much the values of the task force align with the values that council asked them to consider. So it was very easy to meld those two, which is great since at the end of the day they report to you and you'll make the final decision. We heard a lot from them about the importance of racial equity. We heard a lot from them about the importance of regional distribution. We're working really hard to make sure everyone understands that those are different concepts, because in the past I think we sometimes use that language interchangeably. We heard a lot from them about wanting to improve access to all the transportation services and amenities we have in the region. We heard a lot about climate change, carbon footprint, air pollution, environmental justice issues, and we heard a lot about wanting to make sure that this measure increases access to opportunity for people around the region, whether that's by linking more places with job centers, linking more places with workforce training centers or social services. And from the business side, we heard some conversation around freight, but what we really heard is helping people get to jobs. And I think that sort of reflects what we're seeing in the region, which is actually more people are struggling, more businesses are struggling to find the right employees for their work, given commute times and interest, and that's becoming more and more of a pressing business issue. So it was a really great and robust conversation from the task force. At their meeting tomorrow, they will affirm their final set of outcomes that they want to use to guide them through this process, and we're happy to share that with you once it's hopefully affirmed tomorrow. The other big thing, oh, dang it, this never shows up quite the way that I want.
It's not bad on that screen.
Okay, yeah, it's much easier to read over here.
So we also have it.
Oh, I have it. Yeah. Perfect. We, per council's direction, as you may remember, back in February, we brought you a map that showed 60 corridors in the region based on current conditions that we know have the most safety issues and the most congestion issues. And you said, let's start with this map as the foundation. Let's ask the task force to think both about serving our communities of color and serving future projected growth areas, and ask them to think about what other corridors need to be added to that list of 60 for consideration in a measure, acknowledging that after we add all those corridors, the work will be to prioritize them. So last meeting was the meeting of the addition. We added 15 corridors. The task force added 15 corridors to the list. And so you can see, I actually can't remember off the top of my head what numbers they are, but they were things such as making sure 43 was included through its full extent, adding the Clackamas to Columbia corridor in Clackamas County, adding Farmington Road to its full extent, and extending 26 out all the way in Washington County, extending Halsey Corridor all the way in Multnomah County. So we had a fair amount of additions, and I think a robust conversation. It was a harder one for some of our community members, which we knew that the community members generally wanted to sort of follow the data more. Wanted to follow the data and use that as the starting place, and the local jurisdiction folks had additional things they really wanted included. So
which was the point of the growth?
Right.
Showing the growth areas on there and opening up that part of the conversation.
Yeah, so not surprising, and sort of the intention. So now the task force is going to spend the next three meetings thinking about how they want to prioritize and tier those corridors. So we're providing them with some information on how those corridors, the potential of those corridors to improve safety, to increase multimodal options, to connect people to jobs, as well as, you know, how do they look against our equity focus areas? How do they look against our projected growth areas? How do they look against asthma rates around the region? How do they look around housing and transportation affordability rates around the region? So we'll be giving them a fair amount of data, but also asking them to use their best judgment in this conversation. I've sort of said, we're still evaluating, so I haven't seen the full data yet, but if we just looked at the data, it's probably not a measure that's super regional in nature. And so part of their job as task force members is to truly bring their judgment and their experience to the conversation. I should have moved forward to this slide for that conversation. So that's the point there, is we're asking them to bring a whole bunch of other things besides just the data. So that brings us to the end of April and early May, and then over the summer, the local teams will start identifying projects that they want to bring forward to the task force, for the task force to eventually bring forward to you, and the task force will start to consider the region-wide programs. So they are underway, they are working hard, they're a great group, And I think that's the end. We're here to answer any questions.
Tyler, I have a question. For the local teams, how are those comprised? Is it...
We're still figuring that out.
What vision there?
Yeah, the vision is that it's a balance of community members and technical staff from... we'll probably have three or four, whether it's one per county or one per county plus Portland, the city of Portland. And that it'll be a combination of local community members who want to talk about the outcomes on the corridor, and then jurisdictional staff who think about what are the projects that meet those outcomes and how do we help those two folks have productive conversations.
It sort of depends how the corridor tiering process shakes out. And so we've begun conversations with our local jurisdictional partners and with some of our community partners about the best way to populate those groups and manage that process. So more to come on that.
Great. I presented an update on this to the Region 1 ACT last night.
Yeah.
And one of the questions that arose after my update was from Clackamas County, and they were expressing concern with the focus on these corridors, that their problem in Clackamas County is that they don't have access to those corridors. And how would that be addressed? And I wasn't sure how to respond, because I suspect that what Commissioner Savas was referring to is that the areas outside the metro boundary don't have good access into the corridors that are inside the metro area. But I was wondering if, in your discussions around the region, whether you've heard this from Clackamas County before and what a truly appropriate response to that would be.
So we actually, the council president and I went and talked to the mayor's consortium last week, and the mayor of Canby was there and raised a similar sort of concern. He did not ask to come within the metro boundary or have us fund roads outside of the urban growth boundary, but he did indicate that there are routes, corridors that come up to the edge that are important for residents of Canby to use to get to jobs, to get to where they're trying to go. So I think we heard interest there in thinking about corridors not moving outside the region, but the impact of satellite cities have on the corridors that we're looking at. And I think that's what probably Commissioner Savas was trying to speak to.
My response to him was to say that when we initially looked at corridors, that we were identifying existing corridors that were dealing with congestion, and then realized that did not address the issue of growth and where are we going to grow in the future, and needing to include those potential corridors, and that hopefully as we expand our vision to look at that will help address the issue that he'd brought up.
Well, and indeed, the last meeting of the task force was the moment for folks to bring forward corridors that address some of those very issues, and people did. Number 51 up there, which is 213, is a good case in point of a corridor that largely serves people coming into Oregon City and from that part of Oregon City and getting into the rest of the region. So that's one example.
Of course, I had prefaced my update of T2020. By telling the group that the Metro Council had recently decided that instead of going to the people for a measure in 2020, that we had, in light of the fact that we've not received adequate funding from the state and the federal government over the last 30 years, that we were going to sue them for $20 billion instead of go for a bond measure in the region. And they quickly realized it was an April Fool's joke. When I was going over it in my mind to do this, actually my major concern was that even after I had expressed that it was an April Fool's joke, that there may be people around the table who would consider it perhaps a good idea.
Mm-hmm. Was your presentation to, who was it?
Region 1 ACT.
Are there questions or... It does not. No, we were really just here to keep you posted on where the conversations are going. I think generally we're feeling very good about the work and the the way that the task force members are kind of sticking with it, we've pushed them to move very fast, and they're feeling it, they're expressing it. We're going to try to move through this corridor process relatively quickly, and that's going to be a little painful, but we hope that that gets us on a good footing to really start developing projects and move into a programs discussion as well. Not surprising that we're all feeling a little bit of this sense of moving quickly along.
Yeah.
I'd just like to add, I heard a comment made by elected in East Multnomah County. They're really pleased that the Halsey Corridor was accepted to be on this map. But they framed it as if it meant that it's going to be funded.
I didn't
say that. So I think that the realization still has to sink in that we added all these extra corridors, but that doesn't mean they're going to be able to be funded. And at some point, I assume people will start figuring that that will be more clear. But right now, there's some euphoria over that their project has been accepted.
Yes,
and
yes. I think we'll have the same problem as we start tiering and trying to understand what does it mean to be in the first tier, which we think is probably a pretty slim number, versus the second tier. And for us, it's a good indication to local jurisdictions that if they want to spend time and resources planning further projects in those corridors, it's a pretty good bet that it's a good possibility to get into the final measure. And if they're further down on the tiers, it's a more risky bet. It may be a good thing to spend resources on planning those projects anyways for other funding purposes. So we're trying to make that clear to folks, but it's left a bit gray. There's no definitive answer to what it means to be Tier 1 versus Tier 2.
The other comment that I've heard is, it's kind of like reading between the lines, but I think I'm hearing that some people are, if the project has been accepted to be on the map, that also means it's going to be fully funded. And that is, I think, after I assume at some point we'll be making that more clear, is that we'll be targeting these funds to do projects that highway funds won't do. And so that doesn't mean that the middle of the road is going to be paved or widened, but it might mean we'll be adding lanes for buses and that kind of thing. And that I don't think is clear entirely yet.
I think all these things will have to continue to be reemphasized for the task force and the local community investment teams as they start developing projects. Because, if you're not sick of saying it, the meds certainly haven't heard it. And so
that's a good basic philosophy.
Yeah, we're getting constant reminders of that.
How's the composition of the task force? I know the first few sessions we've had some turnover. How's that going, just in general? How many people have we had?
We're feeling very good about it. Even at the second meeting, we had some folks that were taking others' places who'd been already appointed, and they showed up and have been engaged. So we're getting pretty high level turnout at the last meeting. I know we've had some folks say, a couple folks say they can't make it to this next meeting. The sense I'm getting is people are very apologetic for if they have to miss a meeting for some reason. They're letting us know, but we're getting a pretty full table. We've offered and have indeed followed up with folks afterwards or beforehand to give them an update on what happened at the previous session and share information they may have missed. So we're offering up staff resources to folks to get caught up. We're also developing a process to provide technical assistance, especially to those who aren't jurisdictional members at the task force and don't have a bevy of staff behind them, helping prepare them for those meetings. So we've gotten some good positive feedback already on that concept of providing some technical resource so people can ask and get answers to more technical questions. The next phase of the process here, we're going to ask the task force members to do some homework, as we noted, and sort of pick their top 15 corridors they'd like to advance. We're going to ask them to think about it from the perspective of making a proposal to the voters. So don't just think about it from your area you come from, but what would be compelling. Maybe you pick up a particular subtopic like safety or congestion or transit access, and that's what drives you, but think about it from a regional perspective. Using that plus the evaluative data that we'll bring plus readiness data, we hope to be able to, in that other diagram you saw, get to a place where we're have a proposal for a tiered set of corridors and ask the task force at their next meeting to really engage and have some conversation. Why'd you pick that one? Why'd you pick this one? What makes you think about that area, moving people through that area? Why safety versus congestion as a focus for you? And use that to get to May with a final tiering of the corridor list. So that's the thinking we have going forward. We're working on a weekly basis with the co-chairs to walk through these agendas and the process, and they've been very helpful and supportive along the way. So in general, feeling good about it. It's a very big group. It's a lot to manage. I think some people are feeling a little lost on the edges, but we're doing what we can to make sure we can bring them all along the way.
I think I would just reemphasize that it is 34 people, and they're wonderful. But if we have an expectation that all 34 attend every time, that's not feasible for them.
Yeah.
So we're doing our best to make sure that missing a meet A, that everyone is there as often as is feasible, and that if you're not able to be there, we're helping you participate fully in the next meeting and making sure you don't miss much.
Commissioner Tree started a little practice of putting the name tents on the corner, saying, those are the people who aren't here this time, so we all can be aware of who they are, and a little bit of, you know, shaming folks into knowing that you'll be noticed that you're gone, and also talking about the importance of being there and the value of everyone actually participating all the way along. So they've been wonderful.
And then pictures of the absent people get tweeted out to the world.
So, no more tweeting these days.
We didn't go quite that far.
Not tweeting anymore. I give up.
Not yet.
My next question is, how does Southwest Corridor pop up in this map, if at all, and how are we communicating that to different members of the task force?
That's a great question. So the two, and as always, Councillor Dirksen and Councillor Stacey are our resident Southwest Corridor experts. But both I-5 from downtown Portland through Tigard and Barber Boulevard show up on this map as areas that have key congestion and safety issues. And Southwest Corridor is really envisioned as a solution or a necessary part of the solution to addressing congestion on those two corridors. So our plan with the task force, we've been really upfront all along that our council has said they want the local match for Southwest Corridor to be part of this measure eventually. And so our plan is to sort of show the task force, look, when you apply the same criteria to those roads and to the areas, the Southwest Corridor, as we're applying everywhere else, here's how it does, which, spoiler alert, is well. Right, it's very congested. There are major safety issues on Barber.
It does well from a bad point of view.
It does badly. It needs help. It runs through some important equity focus areas. It connects to job centers, et cetera. We don't want to waste the task force's time in asking them to evaluate whether or not they think it should be in there, because you as council have given your direction pretty clearly. So we want the process to be transparent. We want them to see how it does. And then we'll say, you don't need to use one of your 15 slots on the Southwest Corridor. That's already in there. So try to walk the line between being transparent and not wasting their time.
Are there any other corridors that are like that, that have a magic?
That's the only direction that council's given.
Has the task force conversed at all, asked questions about the size of the measure?
Oh, yeah. And we've been...
Andy, why don't you take that one?
That was a lot.
So, the conversation we've had with them is we're working through this corridor process. We'll work through the projects process. We'll work through the programming process, and not until the fall will we talk about money, both revenue sources and amounts. And so we've gotten some level of acceptance of that. We did have a particular elected official say, well, Shouldn't this corridor process be, you know, based on whether we're talking about $2 billion or $20 billion? And so we navigated that a little bit. But we're trying very hard to work towards developing the need and developing the hunger and developing the desire to make investments before we start talking about tax revenues and what amount is actually feasible.
I think that elected officials' appoint was actually, well, with $20 billion, we could do all of these.
Right.
So why are you making us choose?
Why should we have to prioritize?
Well, actually, for 75 corridors, you would need about $40 billion. So.
Yeah, I think $20 billion is not enough if you're going to do all this.
So it was a little bit of poking back at how much do we need to have some discipline here. And I think we were able to say, one way or another, we have to have a discipline process of narrowing down and having some focus.
Question then. I've mentioned this to you in passing. So I believe your thinking and your recommendation may be to us that we won't be expecting any kind of a match from the local jurisdictions. Is that even part of the discussion? I'm thinking, if there was a match, it would stretch the money even further. But I'm just curious. And if it's too soon to be talking about that, let me know. But I'm just curious thinking about a match and what impact that would have, either negative or positive.
It's early to be talking about the specifics of that, and I think council was really clear that on interstates, you would expect to just be a very small partner on regional components of that investment. For state highways, you would expect to be sort of like a junior partner in the investment. And then on arterials and places where you are more comfortable being the lead partner, that's what we're talking about. So in that context, what I would say is we've said to people, you need to show political support and engagement for this, for the project or the corridor or whatever, or, you know, what it is. And so for some jurisdictions who have money, that might be a financial match. For some jurisdictions who don't, that might be that they do the engagement and work creating support and bringing the community together around the project. They might do some of the planning and design to help it move forward a bit more. They might work to make sure that every, you know, all of the sort of government entities along the corridor pass resolutions in support of it. So there are different ways of showing skin in the game. That aren't necessarily about a financial match.
As I recall, we had previously created a chart that was kind of a hierarchy of road projects and what we would anticipate that we would be involved in funding, certain ones that we would assume are the responsibility of the state and the federal government, other ones that we would identify as qualifying for 100% regional funding, others that would only qualify for portions, and then as you go down the list, then only if you've got a regional partner that would provide the majority of the money, and then other like local streets, neighborhood streets that would not qualify for regional money. And I think that's something we created some time ago, and I think that probably is still valid to use as a guide for this
early
group.
This year. Yeah, that was the direction you gave us early this year, was to sort of clarify not putting regional resources behind the interstate system, but looking at ways to potentially help make those investments the state and federal government are making work better for the region. And then a separate category of sort of limited access highways where you'd expect to be a partner with the state financially, and then regional arterials where you're comfortable being a more major investor. We've shared that with and described that to the task force, I think, in their second meeting. So try to make clear your direction in that regard. Any other questions or?
Not a question, just a reflection. I just want to say I'm very appreciative of the work that has gotten us this April 2nd, 2019 map, and I'm really happy that you did not date it yesterday, although I'm sure you did it yesterday. but if it said April 1 on it, I would be less pleased, despite the quality of the work being really good. So looking at my jurisdictions, I was with my own city council last night at West Lynn, and just all of the work that I've been doing, getting out, meeting with local electeds who are not part of the process, and I know you've seen some of my electeds show up to give public testimony, but I can at least look at this map and know that our story's been heard. Our commute shed is more than what is within Metro, and that data is hard for us to even look at here. But the stories and the peak congestion, I know we're looking at non-peak congestion as one of the drivers for the data side, But in terms of getting people in and through and across Clackamas County, I see it here where I didn't see it on the previous map. So thank you for the process and for the work.
All credit for the dating decision goes to Alan again.
So that's all we have then.
Anything left? Okay, thank you. And it's your lucky day, Andy. You get to stay
around
for the
again.
Legislative
yes.
report.
All about you, Andy. All about you.
So our next item is legislative briefing.
Yes.
Thank you.
So the legislature just had one deadline pass, which is that bills had to be scheduled for a hearing, and April 9th is the date by which bills need to be passed out of their initial committee. Otherwise, they are dead for the session, unless they are in a joint committee or the rules committee. So there are a couple exceptions to that rule, but that means it's frantic time. That means people are running around trying to get amendments that will either address concerns that have been raised and trying to get ready for hearings, and this is the moment of do or die to get those bills out of committee. So there's a lot of burning hair down in Salem. On the carbon bill, that one actually is in the joint carbon committee, so it's free of these rules, but amendments have come out that are good from our perspective, and the approach that we were promoting, which was to allocate resources that could go to MPOs that have climate smart plans, or, you know, plans to address transportation-related carbon investments. And you may recall there was a sort of a fight over how that the transportation-related resources might get distributed, and whether they would go out sort of on a formulaic basis, lift the classic 50-30-20, or would they be much more clearly directed to climate smart type investments at a regional scale. And we kind of got in the middle. The resources would be allocated to ODOT, and there's a directive in there to fund programs like Climate Smart and the outcomes that are embedded in those kinds of programs. So the legislature is sort of splitting the difference of identifying the kinds of things they want to see funded, and they have to have a carbon reduction element to them. And MPOs are in there as an eligible entity to be receiving those resources, but they're landing at the moment on a distribution process that's through the state DOT. So good, but not perfect. Conversations will be ongoing. Bill hasn't even gotten out of that joint committee yet, so there's a ways left to go.
My understanding is that the volume of amendments that have been proposed and seriously considered is in excess of the original language of the bill.
Yeah, I don't know the number of, you know, they have a dash number they're working on for the series of amendments, and I think we're up in the 30s or 40s in terms of the numeric dash that we're working off of on the carbon bill. So lots of discussion that's been going on between legislative leadership, the governor's office, lots of stakeholders. So we're in the midst of that swirl, and so far getting a decent result, but not 100% of what we asked for, which is not surprising.
Regarding the money being final to the MBO through ODOT, are they just talking about the process yet, or is it just too soon? I'm thinking, are we going to have to, one project at a time, ask for the money, or do we get a lump sum, or, I mean, are they in that much detail yet?
Well, too early to ask that question because we still haven't even had the bill sort of advance to the next phase. So that kind of detail could be worked out in the bill, or it could be left to later for ODOT to figure out. It's not actually that dissimilar from what the legislature ended up doing on transit operations funding in House Bill 2017, in 2017, where they gave that resource to ODOT, and transit districts had to go down and make a proposal about how they would spend their share of the resources, which wasn't set in the legislation. They had to sort of argue around how much they should get and what they'd use that for, and they had to show coordination between districts that had overlapping, or not overlapping, but connecting service areas. So the legislature was very thoughtful on that, about trying to get some specific outcomes, which is, you know, they want places like SMART and TriMet to be talking together about service and service coordination. So hopefully they'll be as thoughtful as that here. So far, they have reacted well to our arguments, which are you should focus these resources. If this is about carbon reduction, you should focus the resources on investments that actually reduce carbon and not just spread it around, have it spent on a variety of transportation investments that may, in and of themselves, not actually address carbon reduction.
I would just add that that was kind of what popped up to me too, is just learning and kind of tracking what the how that process works and how does ODOT determine which ones are going to be climate reducing and carbon reducing, and you know what's their methodology for doing that. And I think we've seen where it, you know, we can have sort of different analysis, you know, about how that occurs, and so that just still seems clearly it's up in the air. But, seeing that play out seems like an important component.
Mm-hmm. And we certainly have some allies in wanting to see some clearer connection to the outcomes of the investment you're making. So there's a lot going on in this carbon bill. It's being heavily negotiated. So we'll keep working at it and keep tracking and try to figure out if those answers are something that arrives in the crafting of the bill as it moves through, or is that something that gets kicked down the road to a regulatory process later on. Unclear at this point still. All right, moving on. Housing and land use in general. You may recall Senate Bill 10. This was a bill that was proposing establishing pretty high levels of density along transit corridors, of a variety of different kinds of transit corridors. We have basically negotiated that this region would be exempt from that legislation given the existence of pre-existing, through our framework plan and our functional plan, high levels of density around MACs and other station areas, as well as our Climate Smart Communities plan, that we have, as a region, have established high enough level density to satisfy what the state's trying to accomplish. The author's office has expressed a few times that this is really about other urban areas that have not stepped up and created higher levels of density than single family on some key transit routes in other parts of the state. So we seem to be in a place where that's agreeable at the moment, both by the advocates and the author's office. There was a hearing that was supposed to be set for this week. It got canceled. The bill may just be moved off without opposition to rules to give it time to have more conversation. But the ongoing discussions about language have been somewhat fraught. So we don't know what in the end the result in that bill will be. But we seem to be in a place where we're getting carved out, which is as much as we can do for now.
It sounds like it may go nowhere either.
It may well go nowhere. We shall see. On a related note, the speakers to housing bills, House Bill 2001, which is an effort to create the opportunity for more middle housing by sort of recasting single-family zoning to include triplexes, duplexes, townhomes, and other middle housing. There seems to be an effort to add in some language that would modify our urban growth process and the process of the analytics we use to estimate housing capacity and the need for housing in the region. So that's been shared with us. We weren't involved in the discussion process. We're involved in very, very fast analysis over the weekend by research, planning, and other staff to try to give feedback to the speaker's office. Not something, we're not pleased with this development because we want to support the process of allowing for more middle housing, but there seems to be a need to find votes in the legislature that are across the aisle, and in that effort they've turned to some folks that are displeased with our urban growth boundary analytic process and our entertaining language that we think could be harmful to how we do our analyses. So we're in the middle of those discussions. We'll see where that goes this week. Again, bills have to get out of their first committee, and then we'll know more after that. A similar kind of discussion on House Bill 2.
Just on that, it just to be understanding that, is that their concerns are that if we say that missing middle housing now applies across the board to our single-family zones, then all of a sudden the capacity inside the growth boundary for units grows substantially, and then that eliminates or severely limits the housing need analysis to show that we need to add lands. Is that really kind of the core of this one?
No.
Or is that a separate one?
That's a separate question.
Okay.
And there was language in the original bill that would have sort of limited how much you could forecast capacity would grow by allowing missing middle housing. We weren't as worried about that language, although, again, sort of, you know, pretending you can't see something from our forecaster's point of view is really mm-hmm. not how you do forecasting. Although I think we also weren't, given a lot of single-family housing would have to be torn down to develop a lot of missing middle housing, there's a market impediment against a huge assumption of capacity growth as a result of changing the definition of that single-family zone. We never believed there'd be a massive amount of redevelopment just based off of that, and I don't think our forecast would show that the market would react in that way. There would be key places where a house might get torn down and you build a fourplex. And we're seeing that in some parts of the region where zoning allows for that, but the idea that that's going to cause thousands of units to get established seemed outside of what our market analysis would say. The concern is they're trying to throw some language in, essentially, that would change how we do our buildable land inventory work. And it's language you've seen in the past, which essentially says you have to look backwards. You can't forecast levels of density that you've not seen in the past, which is sort of like saying you can't forecast that hard drives and CPUs will get faster than they have in the past. We know that's not the case, and in particular with density, when density in a corridor takes off, it really takes off, and you see a Division or a Williams or an Aranco Station that didn't exist before suddenly become incredibly dense. It's the nature of how that sort of redevelopment and increased density works. We've called it planning in the rear view mirror. Sort of you have to look back and say, if you've not experienced this level of growth, you can't forecast that it will happen. So it is an effort to put a hand on the scale and to some degree force an analysis that shows you need more land to expand the boundary to accommodate housing. So that it's of that ilk that the language is being proposed that we're finding objectionable.
I like that you're, just to quickly to say, you know, I like that you're really sticking to a principle of let us have scientific-based, you know, forecasting that is not manipulated with thumbs on scales or forcing us to go in a certain direction. Metro's forecasting has been incredible. It's been so accurate, and, you know, going way back, you look at the analysis that we've done, and so I think that's I'm glad you're taking that position.
Yeah, we have some colleagues down in the legislature who don't like the results of what we forecast because it hasn't resulted in the level of urban growth boundary expansion that some would desire, and that's what's driving this current discussion. So. House Bill 2003, this is an effort to sort of identify the inventory of affordable housing. The bill has been recrafted. We've been engaged for some time in discussions with the Speaker's office and others. Initially, it had actually some of the similar language that we're objecting to in 2001 was being considered for 2003. As it's evolved, it's becoming, it affects the metro area less. It would affect our cities. They would, as a result of an analysis that is needed to be, that the bill directs state agencies to develop, cities would have to react. Metro would have to understand the sort of shortfall of affordable housing or housing affordability, allocate out to cities their share of that shortfall, and cities would have to develop plans for how to address that shortfall. And there's some set tools identified in the bill to do that. I think there's a universal sense that it's an incredibly ambitious bill to ask in just a year a set of state agencies that don't do this currently to develop a methodology to identify the existing housing stock, the rental price points of that housing stock, and the gap in forecast housing needed to provide affordable units for populaces in these various cities, and then turn around and try to allocate that out with a strategy that would need to be developed by each city. It's very, very ambitious, not doable with the resources that they have. So we've expressed all that while supporting the notion that having more information in this vein would be incredibly helpful. I think our research center would say we can't even really tell you the price points in these in rental places. We have a good sense of price points around owned housing that's owner occupied because that market data exists. But there is no ready access to information that's more than what we do currently, which is estimations of overall average rents as opposed to specific either unit by unit or even in categories. So we're in discussions about how to be supportive of the concept while raising concerns about the feasibility of the idea.
I would think that it would take a huge effort to create that, and it would begin becoming invalid almost immediately.
Yes, the minute you make the analysis, the market.
Gotcha. The best you can get is a snapshot in time, and then.
We do this kind of work for our urban growth forecast, and it takes us years and lots of collaboration, lots of resource, and when we have a highly developed database to do this work, the state agencies that have been in the bill's proposal, tasked with this duty, don't have the existing resources, staff, or databases to do this work. So,
well, I'm supportive of. Policies that might be answering some of the questions that this bill is raising. Hearing that the burden falls to cities, and there's no mention here of what would be my largest city, unincorporated Clackamas County, I really hope that we're bringing up that county resources would also need to be extended, and if they're being left out of the kind of chain of command, that's a huge implementation problem.
Mm-hmm.
If you've got cities and local jurisdictions that don't include counties, I just hope that we're maybe talking to somebody at counties who can help us raise that point.
Thank you for that. There was language in the original bill or in the earlier amendments talking about unincorporated county areas within the urban growth boundary. I can't recall now whether they were still in the latest language or not. We'd raised that issue that we've got enormous swaths of area that aren't covered under a city, and so they recognize that. I just can't recall now whether it was in the last round of amendments proposed or not.
Thank you.
Yeah.
But there may be some kind of components of it that could be advantageous. It's sort of an advanced version of fair share sort of targets and sharing back to jurisdictions in a way that may be helpful in terms of understanding where are they compared to the rest of the region in their targets and sort of from an informational sort of perspective. Is that something that could come out of this that could be helpful?
It may end up being just, hey, state agencies, go see what kind of methodology you can develop and let's see what that looks like so we can then figure out how can we use that in the future as opposed to the full concept of develop this study by 2020. Cities turn around and develop strategies, and in the metro area at least, you know, do this distribution. That may be too much to accomplish. I think they have goals of mid-2020 having that all wrapped up, which is faster than we even do our current urban growth forecasting work.
And we're already geared up to do it.
Sort of. We don't. Not the full concept of that depth of knowledge about the housing market.
What I'm saying is we already have people who that's what they do.
Right.
And you're asking cities who don't have anybody who does that.
Correct.
And do it in a shorter time frame than we do it. Yeah.
And I think reminding folks that, hey, we in our region have a incentive-based strategy that is getting launched and moving forward and working with jurisdictions to really address that is a good reminder at the same time, and so let's, you know, ways that we can support that strategy and helping them target those dollars, great, and that's maybe where we ought to be at this point.
They also have included two sets of appropriations in the bill, so that's good. They're recognizing this is a mandate to do work that would be unfunded. That also creates a hurdle for the bill to identify those general fund resources. So I think we would laud the idea that they're identifying a cost and trying to find the resources for it, but that may make it harder for the bill to move forward this session. So, all right. Moving on, if that's okay. We have been working, I think we We updated on this before. I've been working with Senator Burdick's office around guns and the authority of agencies like Metro and others to control the carrying of firearms on grounds, not just in public buildings, but on grounds like Blue Lake Park or the zoo, and language that we had been working on in developing with Senator Burdick's office, as I understand, has been included in an omnibus bill around guns. So we'll support that language. We'll see where that legislation goes. But we've gotten that far this session in trying to advance our own authority to regulate carrying of concealed weapons on our grounds. Is there a question?
So this has no influence on the gun shows that occur at the expo. I mean, it doesn't, or would it? I guess I should ask.
Again, I think that would fall under our control.
If someone has a concealed weapon.
Right. The question, I think the question there is, do we allow that activity to occur at Expo, as opposed to, do we tell people coming for picnics at Blue Lake Park, you just can't carry a concealed weapon in Blue Lake Park because we've deemed it not to be an appropriate area to carry a firearm?
I think this might be a Nathan question.
We did provide some testimony, written testimony yesterday about this. I don't think it would impact gun shows. It would leave it up to council discretion about what policies you want to go forward with. It gives us more authority. Really, the statute is very unclear about what a public building is, and it clearly excludes us around who can regulate. It would, at least the way it's proposed right now, would put us under the statute, at least, so they have the ability to regulate, whether it's concealed or just open carry. So, but I think it would become a council decision, really.
On plastics, we submitted, the only news there is that we submitted testimony in support of the plastic bag ban, and I don't have an update from Randy about the status of the bill. Has it moved out of its first committee? I think it's moved out of its first committee. I'm looking at Paul because we were both on the phone with Randy today. So, yeah, with all the land use and other related activity going on, he didn't have a status update on where that bill is. But the mattress recycling bill that we've been involved in is scheduled for a hearing this Thursday. So we'll see how that fares.
Is that what is the specifics on that? Is that where mattresses have to be recycled? They can't be sent to a landfill. Is that basically what that legislation is?
Getting a nod from Paul that yes, you could not send. Does it establish a fee as well?
It was more of a, I think more of a take back that would be banned from landfills than a program that would be established, like the program in Eugene, some counselors visited years ago, to strip them down and recycle them. I don't think a fee is established in the bill.
Great. The last item, we've been tracking this challenge with vending at our facilities and the 2017 bill around the Commission for the Blind priority or preference. We have language that's been drafted. We've been working with some other partners like City of Portland and others to draft up language that would cover our facilities as well as the facilities that they own and are concerned about. We are working to, we've secured the language. We're working to get one of the legislators to introduce that as a priority bill, and I think have agreement to have it sent to rules so that it will not have a challenge with the deadline. But that's the latest we have this week. Should have more soon on once that bill gets introduced and the status of it. There's been some interest in maybe putting a sunset on the language, and we have pushed back hard on that, saying the whole point of clarifying this is that we don't have a challenge with any question around our ability to contract for food service at these various places and use that as a revenue source that supports the functioning of the underlying venue operations. And so just putting a deadline on that in the future where we still have to address this doesn't solve our problem. But I think there's just some sensitivity about not being seen to be going after the Commission for the Blind. So we're continuing to push hard on the not only the impact on the venues, but the impact on state income taxes, which are a huge beneficiary from both the zoo, but certainly every time we bring a convention to town, that's supporting jobs that send revenues on down to Salem. So we'll give you more update on that as we have more news. That's all I have.
Household hazardous waste, did you report on that?
Yes, so that bill made it out of the policy committee, and it's sitting down in Ways and Means. So it's in the queue of bills that will await their fate. It has technically a cost, but that cost can be recovered by DEQ revenues that they can raise. So we're hopeful that we'll fare better this year and get out of Ways and Means because they don't actually have to spend money on the bill. But that's always a process of, at some point, there's a line, and you want to be above that line, below that line, whichever way you want to look at it. You want to be on the right side of the line to get out of the Ways and Means Committee. So we're working hard to make sure that bill is a priority for legislators and get it out of Ways and Means. But that will come later on in the process once they've done the final forecasts, have a much better sense of how much resource there is for the state. Only then do they decide what bills can move out of Ways and Means.
Senator Betsy Johnson's bill, the North Washington County UGA edition?
So there's a bill that would change the definition of lands that were added to the UGB. Is that the one you're referring to?
Rural Reserve, Urban Reserve. I might be off.
So there were two bills. There was a reintroduction of a bill from previous session which would change urban and rural reserve designations. We've not heard anything more on that legislation. There's another bill that, that's not a Betsy Johnson bill. That's a separate issue. But that is a bill that would change the Grand Bargain decision to put a condition on lands in North Hillsboro. And the condition was that be employment lands. The legislature put that condition on, and the proposed bill would remove that condition from those lands. So that those lands were added to the urban growth boundary in the Grand Bargain. And this just takes away a condition that the legislature placed itself, not something that Metro did. So we have been neutral. City of Hillsborough has been neutral on that bill. I actually don't have the status of it. But the other bill around urban and rural reserves, I don't think has had a hearing. We have not heard a peep for quite some time on it, is my understanding.
How about diesel? Anything on diesel?
I don't have any new news on that. I know there were a couple hearings. There were some amendments. The last we left our heroes in that bill, I had a good sense that something was moving forward. But I'm sorry, I don't have any more. We can find out.
I'd be interested if there's just something to forward it. Okay. I'm going to be going to an event later this week where
just on the status of it,
conversation about diesel.
Okay.
Yeah,
can do.
The Washington legislature allocate money for the Columbia River crossing from their side, or were they proposing a vote?
My understanding is the governor included money in the budget proposed to do planning work, and that is somewhere in the legislative budget process. There was a committee in the Senate that voted to fund the bridge, their share of the bridge. And I don't believe it's advanced beyond that committee's action. So it was relayed to me that was sort of a statement of support from some key senators as opposed to a proposal that was meant to advance to final conclusion.
Cool. So has the Oregon legislature had any conversations around CRC and kind of the leadership that Washington took on that, aside from Governor Brown's?
Not that I'm aware of any formal discussions about actually putting funding into CRC. There have been some quieter side conversations relating to the budget around the potential for putting money into restarting the planning process, sort of like what the Washington side governor's office has proposed. But we haven't heard more on that. It's been deliberately quiet.
Okay. Well, it's quite amazing that you can track all of these issues on top of, a transportation measure, a housing bond, an open space measure that you're all working on.
Well, thanks to Randy and to our contract lobbyist, Jack. They're doing all the heavy lifting down there, and I'm just relaying to you the information that they give us. But thanks.
Thank you. I did want to mention, I didn't mention earlier, that Councillor Stacey is also excused from our council meeting. Don't want to get him in any trouble. And now we move on to the Chief Operating Officer for updates.
So I only have two things. First of all, I want to make sure you all saw Andrew Scott's email yesterday about Tim Collier. I'm sorry that he left the room, but Tim's going to be the chief financial officer for Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue. His last day will be May 10th. Those of you who know Tim know he's a driver. He's a fierce advocate for good fiscal practices. He's also an incredible soccer fan and a little bit sarcastic and the wearer of the best socks. I'm sorry, Councillor Gonzalez. The best socks in all of Metro so far. So I hope that you'll all join me next week in being a little tiny bit sad as we deliver the Tim's last budget message to all of you on the council dais.
Already had the opportunity to accuse him of bailing on us.
Yeah, I told him that he called me while I was on college visits with my child last week, and I was like, couldn't he have waited until April Fool's Day to tell me this so I could at least have, like, no, this isn't true for a couple of seconds. Andrew Scott will be selecting an interim and then, of course, proceeding to the recruitment process, so I'll ask Andrew to make sure we keep you updated on what's going on with that position. But in the meantime, please give Tim as much grief as you possibly can. Hugs are, yeah, you might want to wait till May 10th to hug him, his last day. Never mind. Then second of all, I think you got a comprehensive update from Roy Brower yesterday about all the solid waste permitting actions. I particularly want you to know that we're getting a lot of incoming testimony around the City of Roses proposal. It's actually located in District 1, but we're hearing from a lot of District 5 residents, and there's a lot of activity on social media about it, and some of it's quite unpleasant. And so just in case you all hear about that proposal, a City of Roses facility, it would be really close to the Costco, if you know where it is, out between Sandy and Airport Way. And there's a proposal to put a new transfer station out there, and you'll be hearing that license recommendation in May. In the meantime, next week, April 9th, there will be a joint hearing that we hold with DEQ about the various permits that are required for that. So there'll probably be quite a lot of activity in the next week or so about that. Yeah, you're hearing it, yeah.
Well, I'd love to, if I could get a little more extensive briefing on that, I'd really appreciate it.
Happy to do that.
Thank you.
That's really all I have.
Thank you. Okay, council updates.
As I mentioned earlier, I did attend the Region 1 ACT meeting last night, and I mentioned that they had asked me to give an update on T2020. And there were a couple people around their table who thought that the lawsuit was a good idea, but only a couple.
And Region 1 ACT, was that?
That is ODOT. The state of Oregon is divided up into transportation regions, and I'm our representative on the Region 1 ACT. Yeah. Okay. ACT means Area Commission on Transportation. Also, we got updates on the STIP program, the 2020, the next round. And this has been real controversial because of the amount of money that's actually available for improvement projects that ODOT is referring to as enhanced projects as opposed to fix-it projects. You may have heard these terms before, dividing the available funding up into fix-it projects with the priority being on fix-it, and then there's enhanced. And recognizing that there's not very much money for enhanced projects, what they're referring to them as is leverage projects, where if they're going to be doing a fix-it project anyway on a facility, are there improvements that can be made at the same time where a small amount, extra amount of money can go a long way because you're building something anyway? And we've been very concerned about where ODOT would choose to do that. And we had previously suggested that they need to make sure that when they do attach enhanced money to a fix-it project, that it not be based on where the fix-it project is, but where the enhancement is really going to do the most good. And ODOT had created a 150% list and then was carving it down to the 100% list. And again, we were concerned because we and the other stakeholders around the table really hadn't had an opportunity to provide our own input into what we thought those projects should be. Well, at this meeting, we reviewed the 100% list that ODOT is proposing. And I and staff had reviewed the list And actually, we are in full support of the recommended projects that they have put forward in the 100% list.
Can you list some of those? Like off the top of your head.
Sure. Improvements to Lombard, 82nd, TV Highway, and can't think of the... That's some of them, yeah. And I can provide you with the full list. Some of them are come under safety. Some of them come under active transportation. Some of them come under highway improvements. They're separate categories. And I can forward that spreadsheet to everybody if you'd like to see it. The same is so for the STIF program. That's the transit portion that came out of Bill 2017 to provide more transit funding around the state. And there was they put in a request for proposals for projects from TriMet and also for other transit agencies around the region. And we had received that list of projects and had an opportunity to respond whether we would support those projects or not. And every one of the projects got majority support from the people around the table. In fact, the only negative questions were with regard to the Frog Ferry that we had a briefing on that, and there was a question from a couple of the stakeholders about some of the components of the proposal. And I think that some of the problems there lay in the fact that, if you recall, the presentation we got was from a private group who was promoting this. And they're the ones who, I think, put together the proposal, but then that proposal was carried by TriMet. So it shows it's coming from TriMet, but I think it was actually written by these folks. And so the language in it is a little bit different than we in government circles is used to hearing, because it was coming from a private group, and so I think there were some questions around that. But in general, the group around the table at the Region 1 Act, and it's the representation there is similar to what we have on JPAC, where there's representatives from the counties, from the cities, from other agencies like the EPA and others. But there was general acceptance of that proposal of all of those projects, including the Frog Ferry, moving forward to the state committee, who will actually be the one who makes the decisions about which ones will receive funding. But the level of funding provided by House Bill 2017 was such that it was sufficient to fund all the proposals that were being put forward, and all the proposals were deemed as being worthy of consideration.
Other updates? I'm not hearing any, and so seeing no further discussion, the work session is adjourned.
Yeah.